Welcome to the Republican Professor. It is 31 May 2024. I'm recording this from, I was going to say the great state of California, the state of California, Orange County. I'm going to a funeral on June 10th for my best friend in graduate school, Dr. John William Boswell. We're grieving John William Boswell here at the Republican Professor because, well, he was my best friend in graduate school, and he was a major inspiration for the Republican Professor podcast and project. The project includes a Substack, a podcast which is heard around the world. It includes a blog and two novels, The Adjunct and The Republican Professor. John was there for me at some of my lowest points in graduate school, especially toward the end there. What I mean by the end is I was in a PhD program, well, allegedly making progress on a PhD for a total of 11 years. Some of that was a leave of absence. Some of it was very difficult because I was teaching, and only when my teaching let up through really no fault of my own, just through lack of enrollment, was I able to continue. John and I finished at the same time. And so the last 4 years was comprehensive exams and proposal, and then the long march of the dissertation, which was interrupted for me and had some jolts and starts. And I mean, John was there getting me over the wall at several key points. John was a war hero. He was retired Special Forces Delta operator. He was awarded the Silver Star in the battle that Black Hawk Down was based upon, you know, and he was a man's man, but he was very gentle. He went to college after his army and contractor experience, having put down bad guys for a long time. He had great stories about going through his undergraduate at the University of Denver and sitting in classes where they might have been discussing something about the Cold War, and John would share with the class what it was like being stationed in West Germany and looking at the Iron Curtain, where the guns were pointed toward the inside. They were pointed toward East Germany. He and I were both anti-communists, very concerned about the socialist threat, as he wrote about under a pen name, Spencer Roan. He and I did not see eye to eye on everything. I would have never written under the pen name Spencer Roan. I would have chosen the pen name John Marshall or something like that, if you know that debate. So we were on different sides of certain things, but we were both anti-communist and very deeply concerned about the socialist threat. We were very concerned about what we both saw as contributing to it, which is that we have a bunch of goons running higher education and they're grade inflators. And so we're graduating citizens that don't know how to think critically. They're not aware of how to evaluate their own biases, and they certainly have a hard time correcting for them. They don't read. They think that libraries are a joke. They're stuck with their faces on their phones. John carried a flip phone. He wore jeans. He didn't wear tactical pants or attire. I once asked him if he had it because I was in the middle of concealed carry debates and activism here in SoCal. I was one of the moderators for a debate for the Orange County Sheriff on concealed carry, where the Orange County Sheriff who won, Don Barnes, he was there. A lot of my friends had concealed carry permits and carried, so I asked John if he did, and he said no. He carried a gun for years, for decades in the Army, and he said he was done with that. So that was the kind of guy John was. He was a man's man, but he was very gentle, wore jeans, had a flip phone. When I asked him about his flip phone, he said he didn't want to be a dot on somebody's screen. He'd been on the other side of that far too many times. Sometimes he did come off as a little bit paranoid, but I always listened carefully to what he had to say, and he always made a lot of sense. I would have never used the term paranoid of him. But I think that once Biden was elected, I noticed there was a change in him. He became it appeared to me he became more anxious, and for good reason. He thought that the country was in real trouble, and right around the pullout of Afghanistan, we lost contact. And I, you know what, I just assumed because we talked about these kinds of things, I just assumed he might be just crazy enough to go back over there and with some retired people, try to get some people out that the Democrats in charge of the United States had left over there. And I didn't. I knew that if that was the case, there's no way I could talk about it on any kind of electronic device with him. And so I just have to wait until he regained contact with me somehow. Well, I never heard back from him. I texted him on Veterans Day. He was usually the one that texted me on Veterans Day. That's the kind of guy he was. But it appears he may have taken his own life last year, and I've just found out about it a month and a half ago from his wife. And I'm going to go to the funeral, so I'll tell you maybe more about that if that's true. I don't know. I only want to honor him because let me tell you, it was conversations with him at some lunch counter in Claremont. Some diners or over a beer or lingering in a classroom after a Uhlman class that he and I shared things, and we were two peas in a pod. We were both veterans. I had had a top secret clearance since I was 19. I had done some special operations, special projects, that kind of a thing. And so we were able to connect on some like recon stuff, surveillance stuff, security issues, just generally. And we also just had a love for America. And we were both older. We both knew that we would never be hired by the goons in charge of higher education, the great inflators, the socialists, the people that want to pretend they want to redefine words every 5 minutes, the Heraclidean tattoo artists. We were both concerned about the same things. He wrote a dissertation that was quite a powerful attempt to help America save herself from herself. And that's in Claremont Special Collections. There were several times where I was not sure. I never felt like quitting, but there were several times where I wondered how I was going to be able to continue in in the work I had in mind and that I had envisioned. And he was there sometimes when I was out of steam, reminding me of deadlines, sending me forms that I had to put in, helping me over the wall. And we did not share a spiritual connection. He would let me talk about it. He would let me talk about the work I did at the church. He would let me talk about, he had a curious presence. I don't think he was able to connect with it, but I was looking forward to future conversations. And now I really miss that, and I'm sad that we can't have those conversations about what's happening in the country and what the world means and how can we help. Because that's what motivated both of us. He was retired, he was fine financially, he didn't really need to teach for the money. He had made quite a bit as a contractor, he had his army pension. And he'd been there and done that. I wasn't in the same financial position as he was. I always felt like I was a little bit busier than I wanted to be teaching. He only wanted to do like normal graduate school stuff, like have pizza and beer or whatever, and stay up late, talk. And I just didn't have the energy for it. I didn't have the time. I was popping in and out of Claremont, and now I kind of wish that I had taken more time for that. John William Boswell, PhD, Master Sergeant, U.S. Army, retired. We miss you. John would want me to continue with the work we're doing. So we're doing Anthony Ishii, continuing on Sylvester versus Harris, and we're on page 21. Number 7, criminal investigations of straw purchases. These are the findings of fact in Sylvester versus Kamala Harris, 2014. Here's Senior Judge Anthony Ishii. A straw purchase is a purchase that a non-prohibited person makes for someone who is prohibited from owning and possessing a firearm. Straw purchases are prohibited under federal law and may implicate California law. Some straw purchasers have never purchased a firearm in California, and some straw purchasers previously have purchased firearms in California. Gun dealers have the right to refuse to conduct a sale of a firearm. Dealers can also be indicted for conspiring to facilitate straw purchases of firearms and so have an incentive to report a suspected straw purchase. Cal DOJ special agents attend gun shows to ensure that promoters are in compliance with the law and to prevent prohibited persons from obtaining firearms, magazines, or ammunition. Special agents also look for potential straw purchases of firearms. The special agents attempt to identify the parties involved in a straw purchase, such as through license plates, business cards on tables, or observing printed forms being filled out. As many as 4 individuals may participate in a straw purchase at a gun show. Agents spend a good portion of their time attempting to determine whether any person whom they have identified at the gun show is a prohibited person. The special agents attempt to complete an investigation within 10 days because the agents want to be able to identify, intercept the firearm before it is delivered to the straw purchaser. This seems like a waste of time, I'm just going to say, because If you know anything about gun shows in California, they're a skeleton, a shadow of what they used to be and what they really should be. But because of the 10-day waiting period, it's really kind of pointless to go to a gun show to buy a gun in California. Because ordinarily, I mean, the first firearm I ever bought myself was at a gun show in Texas, long time ago. I was stationed at Goodfellow Air Force Base in San Angelo, Texas. I had gone to Houston to hang out with my Uncle Steve, who was an FFL at the time, an FFL1. And he and I went to a gun show. That's what we did. And I was 20 years old, and we had a great time. And I was able to take the gun at that time. I was able to take it the same day. And in California, you have a 10-day waiting period, so it's like what's the point of going to a gun show? Because you have to be local enough to go pick it up after 10 days. So if you have to be local enough to the seller to begin the transaction, there's no special reason to go to the gun show instead of just the location, the brick and mortar gun shop. Whereas gun shows in other states, you see things maybe or deals that you don't normally see, and you take the firearm with you when you leave the gun show. That's the whole point of going, is because the sellers there might be from a different part of the state. Like, if somebody, if we didn't have the 15-day, the 10-day waiting period in California, a gun seller from Northern California could come to Southern California, offer special deals that would be enticing. And I wouldn't have to worry about going way up there, 10-hour drive to go pick it up after 10 days. So the 10-day waiting period restricts everyone to their locality within the, and a huge state like California, that's a big deal. It's really a restriction on commerce designed to kill the firearms industry here in California. So Ishii is giving you these findings of fact under criminal investigations of straw purchasers. But that's my commentary on the pointlessness of these special agents doing this. I mean, it's really a waste of taxpayer money. So the special agents attempt to complete an investigation within 10 days. Because the nature of the investigation, if how are you going to do, how are you going to possibly do this? Were you just scanning license plates in the parking lot? These are huge parking lots. And then, if you get a hit for a criminal, I mean, that would take forever. It's just weird. I don't, I, there's nothing specific about a gun show that makes it more vulnerable to straw purchasing. You have to do the same, you have to go through the same process. Doesn't matter if you're indoors or outdoors. Because of the nature of the investigation, if the waiting period were 3 instead of 10, it would be nearly impossible for the special agents to complete an investigation of a gun show straw purchase prior to the delivery of a firearm. Why in the world would that be a problem? Let's say that the firearm is delivered. Okay. Go get it. What's the problem? You got probable cause right there. Get the warrant, go get it. then you might even be able to arrest the people that sold it to them. What's I don't see the problem. Why do you need 10 days? Sorry, Anthony Ishii, continuing. The special agents prefer to intercept a firearm before the firearm is transferred from the straw buyer to the prohibited person. They prefer. So their preferences are running the whole show of constitutional rights. Oh, I see how that works. Well, that's not his answer. Don't worry. Why? Because it keeps the firearm off the street and out of trouble. Well, I want you to consider the following. A prohibited person may well want that firearm for lawful purposes, not on the street at all. In fact, if it is on the street, it makes it a lot easier for the police to get it off the street because it's on the street. And if it's being used for self-defense of the home, it wouldn't be on the street. If it's used for self-defense, look at a dissent that Amy Comey Barrett did when she was on the Seventh Circuit called Cass Cantor versus Barr. She says that the Second Amendment protects prohibited people who want to protect themselves too, as long as they're not violent. So if you committed mail fraud, I think this guy committed mail fraud in that case. He has a constitutional right to protect himself too. So the assumption that the firearm would still be used for unlawful purposes is really odd, and it's not quite justified. There are other ways in which the special agents become aware of straw purchasers besides observations at gun shows. And I'm still stuck at that. Like, what is the observation of a straw purchase? I mean, what does that look like? Do you just look for all the black people or all the Hispanics? And that sounds like what it's saying. I mean, what does a straw purchaser look like? You can't tell ahead of time. So how do you just base it on observation? The Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives and the gun show dealers themselves may report suspicious activity, as well as special agents' inspections of a gun dealer's records. Depending on when the information is obtained by the special agent, the 10-day waiting period may aid the special agents in determining whether a transaction is a straw purchase and may help the agents intercept the firearm. However, sometimes the special agents must go retrieve the firearm from the straw purchaser because the firearm has already been delivered. For straw purchases detected through an inspection of a dealer's records, the firearm in question usually will have left the store by 30 to 60 days. There is no evidence concerning how many straw purchase arrests are made, violations determined by the special agents. I would think that there would be not very many at all. There is no evidence that describes what percentage of straw purchase investigations are from gun shows or ATF reports or dealer reports or dealer inspections. However, in approximately 15% of the straw purchase investigations, the weapon was intercepted within the 10-day waiting period. Approximately 85% of straw purchase investigations do not conclude within the 10-day waiting period, and a retrieval of the firearm may then be necessary. The APP system, we're on number 8. The Armed and Prohibited Persons System, APPS, is a database that cross-references persons with firearm records in the AFS, typically a DROS record, with those who have a prohibiting conviction or circumstance. The APPS database consults each of the state databases involved in a BFEC and MHFPS databases. However, the APPS database is prohibited by law from accessing the NICS system. APPS became active in 2007. APPS is updated on a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week basis. The purpose behind APPS is to identify prohibited persons who have firearms and to enable law enforcement to retrieve the firearms before those persons can use the firearms to harm others or themselves. APPS is a kind of pointer tool that identifies people who may be armed and prohibited in a particular law enforcement agency's jurisdiction. But the information in APPS must be updated and verified before any law enforcement action can be taken. As part of the verification process, dispositions sometimes must be chased down by an analyst. The BFEC and waiting period is designed to stop a prohibited person from obtaining a firearm, whereas the APPS system is designed to retrieve a firearm from someone who has subsequently become prohibited from possessing a firearm. There are 21,000 people identified as armed and prohibited in the APPS system, and these individuals purchased firearms prior to becoming prohibited from doing so. Not every person who has become prohibited from possessing a firearm is in the APPS system. Most of the APPS candidates are pulled from records concerning handguns that were sold in California from 1996 forward. Number nine, wrap back. A wrap back is a notification that Cal DOJ receives when ever someone with fingerprints on file with Cal DOJ is the subject of a criminal justice agency record, e.g., a notification of a subsequent arrest record. Wrap back is fingerprint based, which means the match is done by fingerprint. A non-fingerprint based event, such as a mental health hold or restraining order, would not be discovered through wrap back. Cal DOJ does not receive wrap backs for persons who are arrested or convicted outside of California. Wrap back mainly deals with people who are in the criminal history system who have fingerprints on record. In contrast, APPS deals with people who may or may not have fingerprints in the criminal history system, but who nevertheless are found in a non-fingerprint database, such as the MHFP database. Number 10, CCW licenses. California law provides for either the sheriff of a county or the chief of police of a city to issue a CCW license to a citizen. CCW licenses apply to pistols, revolvers, or firearms that are capable of being concealed upon a person. A CCW license allows an individual to carry a concealed firearm in public. CCW licenses, amendments to CCW licenses, and applications for a CCW license are required to be uniform throughout California. In order to obtain a CCW license, an applicant must prove to the sheriff or chief of police that, one, this is pre-Bruin, 2014, one, the applicant is of good moral character, Two, good cause exists for issuance of the license. And three, as long as that good cause does not mean self-defense. For some reason, self-defense is not considered good cause. Why is that? I've never understood that. I've never had anybody explain that to me like I was a smart 8-year-old. Number three, the applicant either is a resident of the city or county or has a place of business employment within the city or county and spends a substantial period of time at the place of business or employment. And four, the applicant has completed the training course required by the penal code. All right. CCW license applicants must submit fingerprints along with the CCW license application, and those fingerprints are submitted to Cal DOJ. Additionally, if there is compelling evidence, an applicant may be required to submit a cycle to psychological testing before being issued a CCW license. Once Cal DOJ receives the fingerprints, Cal DOJ sends a report to the licensing agency related to the CCW license applicant, including whether the person is prohibited under state or federal law from possessing, receiving, owning, or purchasing a firearm. The sheriff or chief of police may not issue a CCW license until he or she receives the Cal DOJ report on the CCW applicant. No CCW license may be issued if the Cal DOJ determines that the person is prohibited by state or federal law from possessing, receiving, owning, or purchasing a firearm. Once a CCW is issued, it is valid for up to 2 years. The sheriff or police chief may include reasonable restrictions or conditions they deem warranted, including restrictions as to the time, place, manner, and circumstance under which the CCW license holder may carry a concealed handgun. With some exceptions, the general rule is that a CCW license has applicability throughout the state of California. A CCW license may be revoked whenever Cal DOJ or the issuing local agency determines that the CCW license holder has become prohibited under state or federal law from possessing, owning, receiving, or purchasing a firearm. If Cal DOJ determines that a CCW license holder has become prohibited, then Cal DOJ is required to contact the local agency that issued the CCW license. If the local agency revokes a CCW license, that local agency must notify Cal DOJ. BOF, Bureau of Firearms, does not issue CCW licenses, but does accept the applicant's fingerprints and runs a background check on the applicant in order to ensure that the applicant is not prohibited from possessing a firearm. The BOF forwards the result of the background check, along with a copy of the applicant's California criminal history, to the sheriff or chief of police. BOF considers an approved background check to be good for 30 days. Sheriffs or chiefs of police rarely issue CCW license within 30 days of the completed background check. And some agencies may wait as long as 9 months after the background check before issuing the CCW license. CCW license holders are subject to the wrap-back system. CCW license holders have a CII number. Sylvester, that's the plaintiff, possesses a CCW license issued by the City of Hanford Chief of Police. Okay, we got certificate of eligibility. Next. This is the last section of the findings of fact 11, certificate of eligibility. A COE is a certificate issued by the California Department of Justice. In order to obtain a COE, a person must make a request for a COA, COE to Cal DOJ. The COE applicant is required to pay a fee. A COE applicant also provides a full set of live scan fingerprints and is issued a CII number. Cal DOJ is then required to examine its records and the records in the NICS in order to determine if the applicant is prohibited by state or federal law from possessing, receiving, owning, or purchasing a firearm. If a person passes the background check, pays the filing fees, and submits the fingerprints, then Cal DOJ is required to issue the COE. A COE is valid for 1 year. COEs may be renewed on a yearly basis by paying a fee. Prior to the expiration of the COE, the holder submits a renewal form, attests to the accuracy of the date in the renewal form, and pays a fee. A COE is one component requirement for several exceptions to the 10-day waiting period and for other firearms-related activities. For example, consultant evaluators who are exempt from the 10-day waiting period are required to have a COE. Along with a federal license, a COE is required for certain transfers of curio and relic firearms and for the curio and relic firearm exception to the 10-day waiting period. Retail firearm dealers are required to possess, inter alia, a COE. A COE may also be obtained for employees of firearms dealers. In order to organize a gun show, an organizer or producer must have a COE. A COE is required for some transfers of used firearms at gun shows. A manufacturer of firearms is required inter alia to possess a COE. Additionally, some individuals in the entertainment industry or individuals working with the military may seek to obtain a COE. A COE reads, this is to certify that Cal DOJ has completed a firearms eligibility check on the above named individual. As of the date of issue, there is nothing that would prohibit the individual from acquiring or possessing a firearm. COEs also identify their date of issuance and their date of expiration. COE holders are subject to the wrap-back system. Combs, that's another plaintiff, possesses a valid COE. Now we are in the legal standard. We're out of findings of fact, and we're now in the legal standard. Okay, the legal standard, Sylvester versus Harris, 2014. The Second Amendment reads, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. U.S. Constitution, Amendment 2. The Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms is an individual right and a fundamental right that is incorporated against the states and municipalities under the 14th Amendment. The Second Amendment protects a personal right to keep and bear arms for lawful purposes, most notably for self-defense within the home. This is pre-Bruin. This is 2014. Bruin was the major case. 6-3, Republicans on one side. Said that the word bear in the Second Amendment also needs to be taken seriously, just as seriously as keep. And the keep is for the home, the bear is for the home and in public. However, the Second Amendment's protection is not unlimited. He's got to say that as a Democrat. He's a Democrat. He's got to go right to that, you know. Oh, it's not unlimited. And long-standing regulatory measures such as prohibitions on the possession of firearms by felons and the mentally ill, or laws prohibiting the carrying of firearms in sensitive places such as schools and government buildings, or laws imposing conditions and qualifications on commercial sale of arms are presumptively lawful. The Ninth Circuit has adopted a two-step Second Amendment framework. Recall that Bruin said that's one step too many. FYI. But back then, 2014, Ishii was saying, okay, we're going to roll with this two-step framework. One, the courts ask whether the challenge law burdens conduct protected by the Second Amendment. And two, if so, the court determines whether the law meets the appropriate level of scrutiny. Under step one, under first step, courts must determine whether the challenge law burdens conduct protected by the Second Amendment based on a historical understanding of the scope of the Second Amendment right, or whether the challenge law falls within a well-defined, narrowly limited category of prohibitions that have been historically unprotected. This is accomplished by asking whether the regulation is one of the presumptively lawful regulatory measures identified in Heller. By the way, that was in Heller's dicta. Okay. It wasn't part of the holding. It was in Heller's dicta. And I really love the way that Catherine Kimball Mazel, judge in the post office case we covered a couple months ago, bearing arms in post offices. I really like how she pointed that out. It was dicta. And how do you handle dicta? Or whether the record includes persuasive historical evidence establishing that the regulation at issue imposes prohibitions that fall outside of the historical scope of the Second Amendment. In assessing the historical understanding, you see how this is focused on history? Not all historical or scholarly sources are equal, and courts should focus on scholarly opinions that are consistent with Heller and McDonald, and on historical sources around the adoption of the Second Amendment, 1791, and at the time near the adoption of the 14th Amendment. That would be 1868. If a law burdens conduct that falls outside of the Second Amendment scope, then the analysis ends and there's no violation. As to the second step, rational basis review is not to be used. Instead, if a law burdens a right within the scope of the Second Amendment, either intermediate or strict scrutiny will be applied. Whether intermediate or strict scrutiny applies depends on one, how close the law comes to the core of the Second Amendment right, and two, the severity of the law's burden on the right. My comment in the margin is, ew. Generally, a regulation that threatens a core Second Amendment right is subject to strict scrutiny, while a less severe regulation that does not encroach on a core Second Amendment right is subject to intermediate scrutiny. The intermediate scrutiny standard requires that one, that the government's state objective must be significant, substantial, or important. And two, that there is a reasonable fit between the challenge regulation and the government's asserted objective. For there to be a reasonable fit, the regulation must not be substantially broader than necessary to achieve the government's interest. The government cannot rely on mere speculation or conjecture. A regulation may not be sustained if it provides only ineffective or remote support for the government's purpose. Rather, there must be an indication that the regulation will alleviate the asserted harms to a material degree. If that sounds overly vague to you, you're not alone. Bruin said, yeah, that doesn't apply to the Second Amendment anymore. And it really should never have. All right, conclusions of law. Burden on the Second Amendment. When the 10-day waiting periods apply, they prohibit every person who purchases a firearm from taking possession of the firearm for a minimum of 10 days. One cannot exercise the right to keep and bear arms without actually possessing a firearm. The purchased firearm cannot be used by the purchaser for any purpose for at least 10 days. Also, in some cases, due to additional costs and disruption to schedules, the 10-day waiting period may cause individuals to forego the opportunity to purchase a firearm and thereby forego the exercise of their Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms. Therefore, the 10-day waiting period burdens the Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms. It is defendant's burden. This is key. This is why he's right. He's right. Judge Ishii, a Democrat appointed by Clinton, said it is the defendant's burden. It is the government's burden. It's Kamala Harris' burden. Remember, this is Sylvester versus Harris. 41, Federal Supplement, Third Series, page 927, 2014. This is the District Court, U.S. District Court, Central California. It is the defendant's burden to show that the 10-day waiting period either falls outside the scope of the Second Amendment protections as historically understood or fits within one of the several categories of longstanding regulations that are presumptively lawful. Defendant has not met her burden. Democrat to Democrat, Ishii is saying, you have not met that burden, Kamala. First, in terms of the relevant historical understandings, defendant has not established that the waiting period laws were understood to be outside the protection of the Second Amendment. The defendant has cited no statutes or regulations around 1791 or 1868 that imposed waiting periods between the time of purchase and the time of delivery, nor has defendant cited historical materials or books that discuss waiting periods or attitudes toward waiting periods between 1791 and 1868. There is no evidence to suggest that waiting periods imposed by the government would have been accepted and understood to be permissible under the Second Amendment. Second, in terms of Heller's longstanding presumptively lawful regulations, defendant has not established that the 10-day waiting period is a presumptively lawful longstanding regulatory measure that imposes a condition and qualification on the commercial sale of a firearm. Such commercial regulations have been recognized as presumptively lawful by the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court did not explain what precisely it meant by the phrase conditions and qualifications of the commercial sale of arms, and the parties have cited no cases that interpret that phrase. Although a parenthetical citation in a Ninth Circuit case suggested that a county ordinance which permitted firearms to be brought to gun shows on county property if the gun was secured or in one's personal possession was a law imposing a condition and qualification on the commercial sale of a firearm. Nordyke did not expand on the concept beyond parenthetically quoting the relevant language from Heller. That's the case. Nordyke may be read as indicating that the manner of how a firearm is displayed for sale is an acceptable firearm regulation. Aside from that case, though, based on a plain reading of the term, longstanding commercial regulations might entail regulations about who may sell, like, for example, a licensed gun dealer or purchase someone over the age of 18 a firearm, what firearms may be sold, prohibiting the sale of certain types of firearms. I don't know about that one, Ishii. I think your Democrat flag is flying on that one. When a firearm may be purchased, no purchases after 8 p.m., or when a firearm store may be located, like zoning ordinances. By the way, good luck finding those at the founding. Zoning ordinances are decades old, not centuries old. In comparison to Nordyke and a plain reading of Heller's language, it's not clear to the court that a 10-day waiting period would qualify as a commercial regulation. Defendant cites no comparable commercial laws that apply to other goods that require an individual to wait around 10 days before completing a purchase. The court is not satisfied that the defendant has shown that the 10-day waiting period is one of Heller's envisioned conditions and qualifications of a commercial sale. Moreover, defendant has not established that the waiting period is sufficiently long-standing to be entitled to a presumption of lawfulness. Included in the concept of a longstanding and presumptively lawful regulation is that the regulation has long been accepted and is rooted in history. It is true that California has had some form of waiting period since 1923. However, as described above, The court is aware of no waiting period laws in any states during the times around 1791 and 1868. Consistent with these historical periods, currently only 10 states impose a waiting period between the time of purchase and the time of delivery of a firearm. Waiting period laws did not exist near the time of the adoption of the Second and 14th Amendments, and they are not common now. That one state may have had some form of regulation for a significant period of time is insufficient for the court to conclude that the law has been so generally accepted that it is presumptively lawful. Further, the 10-day waiting period at issue was not imposed until 1996, and it was not until 1975 that the California began to impose a waiting period that extended to double digits, 15 days. Prior to 1975, the waiting period was 5 days. That's before computers made everything fast. The waiting period that was in effect, the longest in California, was a one-day waiting period between 1923 and 1955 for handguns, and there is an indication that the law was not applied to all transactions. Imposition of a waiting period beyond a single-digit period is a recent development. Noting, and then there's this case, Seventh Circuit case regarding, looks like a First Amendment case. Regarding, says, noting that a 30-day advance notice of requirement to obtain a permit was reasonable under the circumstances of one case, but that a 45 advance notice was a substantially longer period and not reasonable. Finally, the waiting period at issue applies to all firearms. Prior to 1991, the waiting period applied only to handguns. Although the 1996 waiting period is shorter in duration than the 15-day waiting period imposed in 1975, the 1996-1991 waiting period is wider in scope. Applying a waiting period to all firearms is a recent development. In essence, the defendant is simply pointed to the fact that California has had some form of waiting period since 1923. That is not enough. This is another reason why I like this Democrat judge, Anthony Ishii. He does not buy the standard progressive line that later is better, which undermines the entire point of constitutional law. The whole point of having a constitution is that it's unlike ordinary statutory interpretation. In ordinary statutory interpretation, you got an earlier statute, a later statute conflicts with that earlier statute. The later statute wins. In constitutional law, you have a constitution that's earlier. And interpretively, hermeneutically, it means what it said and it meant at the time. Later statute comes along, conflicts with that earlier understanding, that earlier meaning, and is inconsistent with that. Both can't go at the same time. The Constitution wins in constitutional law. That's the whole point of having a constitution. So progressives are always, so-called progressives are always going to have a problem with constitutional law. For them, later is better, as long as the later is not Republican. Never enough. Okay. Here we go. We'll do a few more here. The 10-day waiting period burdens Second Amendment rights of the plaintiffs. That's all. I mean, he went through all that just to say, yeah, there's a problem here. Two, level of scrutiny. Defendants contend the intermittent scrutiny applies to this case. Plaintiffs contend that the court may utilize intermediate scrutiny because if laws do not pass intermediate scrutiny, then they will not pass scrutiny. Plaintiff is correct that if the waiting periods do not pass intermediate scrutiny, they will not pass strict scrutiny. Given the party's focus on intermediate scrutiny and the necessary implication if the laws do not pass intermediate scrutiny, the court need not decide whether strict scrutiny applies. Instead, the court will examine the waiting periods under intermediate scrutiny. And again, I've said this a million times, this is pre-Bruin. These levels of scrutiny do not apply. the way they were playing back then. The two step approach to interpretation of Second Amendment cases and controversies is one step too many, as Bruin said. And so it's not subject to an interest balancing test by a later involving a le later legislative history. The interest balancing was done at the founding and at the adoption of the 14th Amendment. That's when the people did the interest balancing, not later legislators. Governmental interest. Defendant contends that California's important interest in public safety, preventing gun violence, and preventing prohibited individuals from obtaining firearms. Plaintiffs do not dispute that these are important interests. Courts have recognized the state's important public safety interest with respect to various firearms laws. If it is self-evident that it is self-evident that public safety is an important government interest. It is also self-evident that preventing people who are prohibited from possessing a firearm may from obtaining one is an important interest that goes hand in hand with public safety. Defendant has demonstrated that public safety and keeping firearms out of the hands of prohibited persons are important interests. Reasonable fit. Defendant has identified three rationales that it contends are reasonable fits that justify the 10-day waiting period. One, conducting a background check. Two, providing a cooling off period to prevent impulsive acts of violence. And three, investigating straw purchases. The court will assess each of these justifications in relation to the three as applied groups. Okay. So the gauntlet has been set down. The government here, Kamala Harris, has said it's reasonable because we got three reasons. And Ishii is going to say, okay, we got those three reasons. Let's see if it's really reasonable as applied to these plaintiffs. Thanks for joining me on the Republican Professor today. And we'll see you for the rest of this case. We're going to finish this. And then we're going to go to, I think we're going to go back to Catherine Kimball Mizell, the one, the judge that overturned the requirement face masks on commercial airlines. Yeah, we're going to go there. We also have an up Josh Blackman, who wrote the essential free exercise clause and the essential Second Amendment. And we're going to be talking about the lockdowns and the Bill of Rights. We have to talk about that. It's an election year. It's one of the most significant things that happened. And it's still a live issue because it actually happened. And we need to be on record about the abhorrence of that. So, thanks for joining us. See you next time.